Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I'm Brian Dunn.
And I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And Robert, we are talking about Spillers number 6 tonight, which just wrapped up a few, an hour or so ago, maybe less, at Crescent Ballroom.
Yeah. And apparently it's had such an effect on me that when I just said my own name, I said Robert Hookman Jr.
You did. Are you slurring already? It's early yet.
I'm feeling saucy about Spillers 6.
Saucy. Okay, that's that's good. Well, speaking of saucy, one of the great writers who made Spillers number 6 such a success is with us. She's our guest on the podcast. Her name is Erin Stalka, and she read her story, Why Things Fall, Einstein. It was very well received. Everybody loved it. And she's our guest right now, so welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah,
absolutely. Do you consider yourself saucy?
Not really.
This is just something we're
I'm really serious.
Are you really? Really?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sure I would have categorized you as such.
Yeah. What? Now we need some glimpses. Right off the bat.
Oh, no, I feel like I'm not funny, and I feel like saucy people are funny.
Oh, you think saucy and funny kind of go hand in hand?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Were your parents not funny? Do you not know funny people?
My grandfather was hilarious.
Oh,
my
yeah?
My mom is hilarious. My brother's hilarious. It just, skipped me.
Interesting. Well, I like that you can admit to that fact. There's more to life than being funny.
Oh, I was so glad to hear your reading in the middle, Brian, because you were hilarious. And it was a good, because the rest of us were pretty serious. So
there were some serious subjects being bantied about. So, I figured maybe I could add some levity.
Yeah.
So thank you for saying that. It's very nice of you to say.
We should consider finding more humorous pieces. In fact, I think the audience enjoys them.
Yeah. It's a nice palate cleanser.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
So, Erin.
Yes.
I meant every last damn word of what I said when I introduced you. Seriously, the moment I finished hearing that story, I have this reaction sometimes when I hear stories like that. I just sit in a chair for 5 minutes with chills on my arms.
And he usually texts me after and says, oh my God, I'm sitting here with chills.
Read this for
5 minutes. Yeah. Yeah, he gets all excited.
And I absolutely felt that way about this particular story. There's some really, really great, I don't even have kids, but there are some really just jarring and cutting parent to child lines in that story that just knocked me back in my chair. And I absolutely love the concept. And with that said, tell us about how that came to be, how this story collection came to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Your introduction was so lovely and made me so nervous to read. Suddenly I was like, oh my gosh, that was so kind. I have to live up to this. So thank you so much. But
Not at all.
It was a
bad
nice,
host.
No, it was a no. really, it was a really pleasant nervousness. I was like, wow, this actually matters. It was strange reading the story because I wrote it before having had a child. And now I have an 11-month-old daughter. And so it does strike me a bit differently, just because those lines are now more about me than they used to be. The story came from just being really obsessed with physicists and physics and being really interested in the lives of famous people, what we don't know about them. And so there are 4 stories in the collection about physicists. The collection itself took a long time. I've been working on it. I thought I had a collection 12 years ago, and I didn't actually have one until recently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I graduated from my MFA thinking, I've got it, this thesis, it's going to become a book, even though everyone in your MFA program tells you never think that your thesis is going to become a book.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yeah. They're like, it's on the way to a book. But over 12 years, every story from the thesis got cut, and new stories got added. So none of them survived.
Not one survived.
Not a single one survived.
Wow.
So it's a really different book than what I thought I was writing, a long time ago. So much more science inspired, much more science fiction-y than what I was working on back then. So I think of it as hopefully speculative fiction, but maybe not quite so classic tropes of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to the physicist concept in the first place?
So when I was an undergraduate, I was a physics major. I didn't finish the major. I ended up dropping it to a minor once I decided I really wanted to focus on creative writing and I wanted to get an MFA.
Writing with a minor in physics.
Correct. Yes.
Not your typical combo, but a good one.
I started out as
shrimp and orange juice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yuck.
I started out as a double major, and then so I always knew I wanted to do both, but then it would have taken 5 years to do a dual degree in English and physics. And so I didn't used to write about it creatively. In my mind, those were two different things I did. And then eventually that's when I realized that the concepts of physics is what mattered to me more, and that could still be worked out through narrative and could still be thought about through story, not just through equations.
Well, I think the story definitely shows a knowledge of physics. There are some great things that you put in that story that somebody who doesn't even really know about physics, I'm like, well, that is so cool. That is so cool, that connection that, that you know, she made in that story. So, yeah.
I feel like that way with your story, the kind of like musician lingo. I'm like, I don't know the lingo, but I can tell you know the lingo.
Oh,
you know, like I can
yeah.
tell you know about jazz.
Yeah, there was
so
a
cool.
lot of,
glad it worked for me
a lot of jazz musician slang in that story.
Yeah. No, there really was. So, question for you. I read this quote. It was an interview you did with the Kenyon Review. Okay. And you said, when I was an MFA student, I read stories I adored, stories by Ray Carver, James Baldwin, John Cheever, and I tried to write stories like theirs, but I never could. So why could you not write those stories, and what happened that allowed you to write the way that you want to write and that you can write?
Great question. That's just not where my talents lie. I feel like the stories I loved were very scene-heavy, very dialogue-heavy, focused on character, and that's just not, I guess, how my brain works. And so I think that's why I thought I had a collection when I graduated with my MFA, and then I realized that I didn't, because what I'm more interested in is language and concept, and that if I told myself I don't have to write scene and dialogue, then I don't, and I write things I'm more interested in. So, you know, the story I read tonight is a series of letters. Mm-hmm. It's just being inside someone's skull. And it took me a long time to realize that anyone wrote that way, because what I was taught in school was great literature. I just then thought it was the only kind of literature that counted.
Okay.
And so once I gave myself permission to write more, well, you know, once I discovered, you know, Samuel Beckett and people who are very in the skull, I realized, and William H. Gass, I have a story in the collection that's a tribute to him. I said, oh, there's this other thing you can do, which is more impressionistic or mosaic or fragmented. And cares about the line more, the language, the sentence more maybe than character.
Yeah. Isn't that great when you have that moment where somebody presents to you a new avenue or a new option that you really want to go down, but you didn't know if it was allowed, or you didn't know,
exactly.
Yeah, that it was possible. And then you see somebody pull it off and you think, oh my gosh, this opens up a whole new
range. I love that you're bringing that up. That's something I've thought about like 1,000 times. Like,
yeah.
So first, just to what your point, Aaron, it's funny that you would mention that it took you a while to kind of gain the permission to write from inside of someone's head, because one of my favorite books, like since I was a teenager, was Catcher in the Rye, you know, typical, but
yeah, cool.
But that's all very much, you know, first person inside the mind of this troubled youth. And so I kind of always thought of literature as that way. And when I read other Salinger work, it was very jarring to me that it was in third person. I was like, who's this?
Yeah,
this is not
the same.
Yeah. It turns out that I absolutely love all of that as well. But it's like, I think I actually started from the opposite viewpoint of yours. But to that other point, it was when I read like probably Jim Carroll and Bret Easton Ellis, I would say, that I suddenly felt like I had permission to be a writer with ADD and
yes.
to write in chunks. And to reveal a story in just minute passages that build up over time and aren't necessarily causal, that permission, I think, is incredibly important as a writer to find that stuff that lets you break out and do something else.
Entirely. And I don't think it was the fault of any of my teachers, because they kept giving me things I loved. So they kept giving me more of what I loved. But I do now, as an educator, try to give students very strange associative work so that they realize that a piece of fiction can work like a poem. It can kind of leap. And I started out as a poet when I was an undergrad, and I think that was part of my problem, is I thought either you're a poet or you're a fiction writer, and those are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took me a while to realize you can use the same skills. If you just take away lineation and take away line breaks, my work often is very associative. So I got to that point finally. It just took me a long time.
That's great.
We had actually asked your husband, Justin, about a different perspective on that. And it was the idea that, like, he was saying that, you know, he had said previously in an interview that he had trouble occupying those spaces simultaneously, the poetry and the prose. But then it seems he's changed his mind since he said that. Now he's a little more comfortable with it. So it's interesting to think. I mean, they do feel like different skills to me, but they also feel like they can very much lend their flavor to each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that hybridity is sort of a newer idea. Not that people mm-hmm. haven't been writing hybrid work all the time, but I don't know if Justin told you, but we met in a fiction workshop, and then now he's predominantly a poet who gets into best American short stories. Like, he does both, and I think of myself, I don't write poems anymore, but I think my closest poetry teacher in the book for making me think of myself as a poet even when I'm writing prose. So I think I'm more of in sort of a hybrid space these days.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think about him being published in McSweeney's Quarterly 47 and Best American Short Fiction?
Is he failing as a poet in a really successful way?
Should more people fail like that?
I think he's just going to be a triple threat. Like, his book of poems is going to come out really soon. He's shopping it around. I think it's so, so good. He's been writing some essays these days. He has an almost done story collection, 2 chapters of a novel. Like, he just can write anything.
Nice.
And, you know, I think for a while it was really nice that he was the poet and I was the fiction writer, because we weren't directly competing with each other. But then we worked out all that stuff as a couple, where when he finally got into Best American, I had friends writing me and being like, are you okay?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Did they ask that? That's so funny.
Yeah, they just wanted to make sure I wasn't, you know, sad or jealous, because there's been times when my writing career was not going well. I mean, I've had some rough years. Oh. But when he was really finding wonderful success, I was too. I don't think I knew at the point that I had a book coming out, but I'd gotten some sort of like good responses to the book. So we both were doing well, and a success for one is a success for all. So I am not joking when I say my husband is a far better fiction writer than I am. Like, I absolutely mean that. So
oh my goodness.
He completely deserves it. Yeah. I mean, I met him in workshop, man. I was like, that, I want to write like that guy.
How cool.
That's a good reason to marry someone.
I think so too.
What if, it really is a great reason to marry someone. Yeah. And it's just fantastic that you have that kind of relationship where you have that much admiration for the person that you're with. I mean, that's an incredibly difficult thing to achieve for anyone, let alone someone who's in the same biz.
Yeah. We joke that one of us should have married up. Like, one of us should have married a doctor or a lawyer, but we didn't. We're each other's first reader, and I feel grateful for that.
Yeah, he mentioned that. And cool. He said, you're very good at picking up on new things that he's doing. Cool. Yeah. And he said he always thinks that's cool. And you're like, hey, you know, you're doing something different here. And you can kind of like see his evolution in the things that he's trying. Yeah. And he was very appreciative of that. So, awesome. Yeah, thanks. Definitely.
So tell us about teaching in prisons.
I taught 2 prison classes when I lived in North Carolina. So I haven't done that in all the states I've lived in. But I had a fellowship for a year teaching undergraduates at Warren Wilson College, where I got my MFA. And then the second year I was an adjunct, so I had a little bit of time. And there's just a really cool extension program through UNC Asheville in the prisons. And I had heard of other people who had had my fellowship, the BB Fellowship, who had taught in prisons. So I taught in a youth prison, under 18-year-olds, and I taught in an adult prison, both male only. There's only 1 female prison in New York, in North Carolina, and it was too far from where I lived. It's probably the most meaningful work I've done. I could make a living at it, I would do only that. But most people kind of do it as a side gig. It just felt like it mattered. My students were getting college credit, so they were leaving prison with a transcript that would hopefully let them go and actually continue on. But of course, I was having, you know, they could only write their essays on paper with pencil. They aren't allowed access to computers. So I was setting them up to leave prison and get more education, which drastically reduces recidivism, people coming back to prison. But I also understood that some of them like didn't really know how to use a cell phone. So it was really meaningful work and really, in some ways, frustrating, not at all because of the students, but just because of how little support there actually is for people once they are not incarcerated any longer.
Oh, wow. That's so sad.
I would absolutely love to read a nonfiction first-person story from you about the first time you went into one, and how that, like, the transformation that probably would have occurred, I imagine, in short order.
Absolutely.
Did they prep you for Anything that
you know, I took training alongside the guards, the COs. What are the prisoners call them? COs,
oh,
correctional officers. That's okay. What they're actually called. So I did that training, which was sort of like, it was very strange. There's asbestos in the walls, and you should know about that. And
what?
At the end, they all were going to get sprayed with pepper spray in case their pepper spray got stolen from them and used against them, but I got to skip that part. So it was, like, not really helpful training.
No.
Not necessarily. All they really told me about being an educator was don't tell them anything about yourself and don't learn anything about them. Which is not how I operate in the classroom at all.
Yeah, what a terrible teaching model that is, right?
Yeah. But there was no one in the classroom but us, you know? The CO was always outside of the classroom, so there was no one, like, listening in. So I actually have written about my teaching experiences. The essay that got the notable in Best American 2016 was published online, and it's about not just teaching in prison, but all the very strange teaching experiences I've had. I've been the only white person in the room for 3.5 years. I taught in an inner city community college. I've been the only woman several times. I've been the only non-Jewish person in the room because I taught at Yeshiva University for a while. So the essay, I'm turning it into a memoir. So I'm working on sort of thinking through these experiences and what they've meant to me. So it's in process. It's first person. I don't know.
Very cool.
Well,
finish
that up.
Yeah, we want to read that, actually.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
I would read, like, napkin notes that you had written during dinner, like, at this point.
Incredibly kind.
I'm a big fan.
I appreciate that a lot. Thank you.
So I have a quick question about your writing process.
Of course.
Okay. So I read that you prefer to generate drafts early in the morning when you're not fully conscious, right? And so I'm wondering, how does that take place now with an 11-month-old daughter in the mix?
Or are you just always not quite conscious?
Is it a different level of, yes, unconsciousness?
Great question. I'm not currently writing, and that was pretty purposeful. I finished sort of what I could before she came, knowing that I'd want to start something new once she arrived, and that I would want her to sort of tell me the next thing. So I've not been writing. So I don't know yet. I'm not very conscious. I have not had a good night's sleep in 11 months, and so I've had to ask my students forgiveness this semester for being so scatterbrained.
Oh, wow.
But I think the plan... I typically have her in the mornings, so that's typically when I write. So I think this summer is just going to be a negotiation, right? At least a couple days a week. Hopefully the husband will have the baby in the mornings, because hopefully she will be eating solid food and not exclusively breastfed.
Yeah, unclear.
I haven't sorted that out yet, but I will.
Yeah, no, you're going to have to.
It will not kill my writing. It will not kill my writing.
No, you can't let it. But it's funny, because Justin was saying that you guys have negotiated this, and that you've allowed him to write in the morning and work on his novel, which he was incredibly appreciative about. So
he has a project he's really focused on. So I figure if I'm basically taking napkin notes for the next novel. I have a novel that looks like it's going to be a failed novel. Unfortunately, it has three more possibilities of yeses, but it's gotten a whole lot of noes. The next novel I'm just sort of thinking about in my head. So if he's got a project, absolutely. Like, I want to make space for him to do that. And then whenever I'm actually ready to go, I'm sure he'll do the same for me.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We're sounding
will.
All like shiny and perfect.
You
We're
totally
not,
are.
We've
wow.
been together a long time, and so we've negotiated this stuff. We've been married 9 years and together 13 years. So it takes a while of like two artists in a family, but at this point we're handling it.
It kind of comes through in your interviews, honestly. You both used the word. You both talked about the idea that you
negotiate
the situation. Literally, that same word.
Yeah, you did. You both talked about meeting in a creative writing workshop,
so far your story corroborates.
We must dig further, Robert.
I hope he agrees that he is a better fiction writer than I am. I've never actually made him say that, because the ranking's not important. I think he's something really special.
I think he feels the same about you.
I think so.
I think it's safe to say.
Two artists, you know, but I guess, you know, all our friends that are trying to do the same thing, like, it's important, and it's community, and it's what we're all building. And sometimes you do that in a marriage, and sometimes you do that with friends, and sometimes you do that in a reading series. And I don't know. It's important to make art and help other people make art.
It certainly is. I love that sentiment. That's fantastic. Good. All right. Well, Aaron, thank you very much first of all, for making the drive. You've got the 11-month-old. You guys have to stay in a hotel here, which I kind of feel terrible about.
I think you single-handedly contended with more than any spiller.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You get some sort of award or prize or whatever we can do, basically, is
I have
is
so
what
many
we're saying.
Friends in Phoenix, but I feel like I needed the baby like a few minutes away in case I had to like run to the hotel and feed her and come back. But as far as I know, she's asleep. So
good. Fingers crossed on that.
Delighted to have been here with you all. It has been such a pleasure. One of the coolest readings I've done. So
oh, wow.
Thanks for making it happen.
Thank you so much. Ooh.